Good morning. It's the 17th of April, and this is Govindraj Ethirat, streaming and broadcasting from Mumbai, India's financial capital. A particularly warm day, and there are elections coming up on April 19th. And today, being a markets and bank holiday, we decided to do an insightful discussion with special guests on what are the factors that will determine how India will cast its vote in a few days.
This is a Core Report with Govindraj Ethiraj.
The 2024 general elections will see some 18 million first-time voters express their choice on who they will vote. There are some things that are different about this time's elections, notably the fact being that a lot of young voters are perhaps influenced a little differently from their predecessors over the years. But that's just one of the many points that we're going to examine today in our discussion. We're also trying to look at what is really influencing voters this time, and if so, that is that different from previous occasions, and what is the socio-economic and, more importantly, media milieu that they live in. So what we're going to do first is use a survey that CVoter has done and use that as a start point. And the survey is very interesting because it looks at first-time voters and their preferences going into 2024. It's also an interesting survey because it goes back several decades and looks at how first-time voters voted about 50 years ago and how they're voting today and what is changing their choices or influencing their choices. And then we'll go on to understanding voter behavior or even consumer behavior for that matter, if it really converges a little later. So I'm pleased to welcome our three guests, Rama Bijapurkar, author of Lilliput Land, Yashwant Deshmukh, founder of CVoter, and Shankar Iyer, senior economic journalist and columnist. Thank you all for joining me. Yashwant, so let me ask you to start off with a very quick introduction on the survey that you did that led to these findings. So one is, of course, what motivated you to do this survey, and a little bit about the composition of the survey and the key findings.
What motivated was banter with Shankar on how the first-time voters are thinking, and he said that we should look into the archives, and obviously there is no archive of public opinion data as such, you know, going from the 50s till now. So I kind of deployed on his questionnaire a technique which I used in the post-tsunami crisis rehabilitation and that report in Indonesia and other places, basically asking people in retrospect about an incident that has happened in the past. So it became part of our tracker that we actually did a complete random probability survey across India. And the people ranged from 18 to 102 kind of age bracket. And we simply asked them, if they remember which was the first time that they voted, which election was that, which year was that, what were the issues in their mind at that point of time, who influenced their voting intent, which kind of medium were they using, and what kind of medium was influencing them in terms of discussion and debates and everything. And then we did decadal analysis in that way, that those who voted in the decade of 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and so on and so forth. And then try to do a tabulation to see what changed and what did not change at all. So that's how this project started. And Shankar did a brilliant analysis. Rama gave me so many insights on that. So I'm actually willing to listen to these two people more on how they are looking at the data. But it was very interesting to find that, you know, as you say, the proverbial line, the more things change, the more they remain the same in that way. At the same time, we could also sense that the different political happenings during, major happenings during the decades, how they shaped that entire generation's point of view of their political ideologies, how they were shaped due to those events, and how there was a continuity of sort, and if there was a break somewhere, then what were the events that broke that kind of continuity of thought. So all in all, it's a very, very interesting set of data to analyze and to understand.
So Rama, let me begin with you. So this study picks up at a point of time and then talks to people about the past and then correlates it to the present. And obviously the trigger here is these first-time voters. When you look at, let's say, the populace as a whole, whether you split them into voters or consumers or citizens, young people, old people, how do you cast your eye on this landscape?
First of all, I think the demographics are not really great. So I think we are talking about a group of people. While we like to believe that everyone who's young is cool and wanting to be an entrepreneur and about to do a startup and so on and so forth, the fact is that their demographics mirror even more deeply the lower income, modest education kind of profile of the country. So I just want to set the frame to say that it is through that lens we're looking at it. I looked at some data from a company called Kantar. It's the largest market research company, and they just look at demographic profiles. And if you take the 18 to 21-year-old urban Indians in 2023, aside from all the modest income and occupations, about 13% are already married. So I think people are really looking. And if you actually look at the older age group, which is going up to 30, you will find that a much greater proportion already married. So you're talking about people who seriously are looking at becoming householders very soon. If you look at that same number for rural India, if 12% of urban young Indians 18 to 21 are married, the number for rural goes up to about 22%, right? So, jaldi jaldi shaadi ho gayi hai, 69% of them are students as compared to 58% in rural. So, that's one part of it. So, I think we're talking about a group that is in effect mirroring the mainstream demographics of India. They're not discontinuous. Except that more and more of them are actually doing some college, what they say, Teravi, Chodavi, 13th class, 14th class, and so on and so forth. But that's essentially we're talking to. Very hyper-aware, very social media, and maybe later I can come back to a study that I've just done with an anthropologist from IIT Madras, Professor Mathani Krishnamurthy, because, again, directly asking people wasn't getting anything. So I thought, let's try anthropology, of which I don't know much, but she knows a lot. And the findings were actually quite interesting. I mean, they are not the completely engaged, here we are going to vote factors. Of course, we did it in January, but we also find that this group has very, very immediate awareness. Whatever is on social media at this point in time, that's what they're immediately aware of. Within that, so therefore, maybe elections were not on their horizon. But the other interesting thing that she also found was that the idea of India is a cultural sociological space. It's not an idealistic nation ideology related kind of thing. And whatever they're looking at in government equals, the politics equals social issues. And the social issues that they see on social media are the social issues that they're really thinking about. And what about government? Government seems to be an entity that is not connected in their immediate thought as something that I vote, there is an election, and then the government comes. Government is something out there. Government has to do its work for me. Many of them do want government jobs. They also want iPhone 13s. So these are people that we picked who had just entered college, many of whom were first-time college boys and the whole family. They were people who had come from fairly modest places, and they were a mix of big and small towns. So in a sense, they're the leading edge of the young, okay? Not those who are, let's say, dropping out of school in the 8th or the 9th or something like that. So that, from what we can understand from our early results, the whole idea of politics and government and everything is what can you do to attack social issues that make life better for me? So it's all through the lens of me. So that's really what we are coming out as. So it's not quite the apathetic voter, but it is someone who has to be magnetized, like when you magnetize a piece of iron, all the molecules point in the same direction. And the thing that magnetizes them is social media. So extremely aware. So I remember thinking when I saw this that if you had, really well done social media that made it both cool and hot and important and immediate for everybody to go out and vote, and that was a social thing, then you would get a completely different answer as we get closer to the election.
Shankar, so you've now heard Rama more specifically from an anthropological perspective and additionally an anthropological perspective. How are you seeing this?
And my sense is that the engagement of the voter is largely tactical. It is not a strategic engagement. In a sense, India's democracy is a benign monarchy. Every 5 years, you vote a ruler and then you expect the ruler to deliver. So in a modern technology terminology, you will say that they install an app, and then they read the app and say whether the app is delivering or not delivering. At some point, they feel that they will uninstall the app or trash the app. So that is generally the view. I think that whether they are in rural India or urban India, the core question that they address in their engagement is,
Am I going to be better off? Are people around me going to be better off? Is this giving me some sense of predictability, stability? Those are the things that they look for. I'm not quite convinced that they're less emotional. I think a large part of the voting happens, 30-35% is, you know, at the last week or the last post-voting. And that is driven oftentimes by an emotive issue or a statement made by somebody. So in a sense that while they're looking at the aspirational questions that they want addressed, they're also influenced by peer group. And typically, I mean, this is not unique to India, the younger the voter, the more likely they want to be on the winning side, because they don't want their first vote to be cast to... And so there is the aspect of the rebellious youngster, but that might be in their articulation. I don't think that there is much of that in their action. Unless the two caveats being the radical change or the regime change elections. Regime change in India happens on two counts. One, when the basic fundamental rights are sort of impacted, so you would be protected. So that is the first aspect on which they would vote with their feet. The second aspect is corruption. And corruption, I tend to sort of, there is an acute connection or a triangulation with how well they are feeling about themselves and their lives. So if they are not feeling well and they see corruption, this is the thing that will trigger, catalyze votes. And again, that is visible in 67 elections. It was visible in the 89 elections. There is a perception that, you know, undercurrents have to be harvested. I think regimes in India are changed by the voters. I don't think the opposition party has much of a role because they just come and harvest what is delivered to them. So if you see in 1989, one man, V.P. Singh, Boforska, Dalal, Boforska, whatever he said, did it. In 2014, similarly, the multiple 2G, 3G, whatever the truth of those issues were, the perception was that this was a government on the take and we didn't want it. So I think the engagement is tactical in terms of the cost of repeating. I'll say that they plug themselves or unplug themselves from the issues on the basis of their daily experiences.
Right. Rama, so if you were to look at, rather, you know, when you look at young people today, or let's say older, you talked about the 30s, for example. Now, how are they different in their aspirations? And whether we'll come to whether we can link it entirely to voting choices or not, but how are they different in their aspirations in a broad sense between, let's say, this generation and the previous one?
Want more? I think they're more hyper-aspiring. Also, you know, aspiration is often about having enough exposure so that you can, exposure to things so that you can write your own story. You don't aspire when you're sitting in a dark room with no inspiration at all. So this is an overstimulated generation, as we're hearing. It's all about social media. It is about what they see and hear. It's about, so they are overstimulated. They are writing in items, whether it is a branded handbag, whether it is a iPhone, whether it is the kind of house, the kind of car, which cricketer got what. So they're extremely aware and concrete in terms of what they want. Their aspirations are very consumer-oriented. But the aspiration is also for a good house. The aspiration is basic. The aspiration is also for government jobs, stability. I mean, we hear a lot about wanting a government job, wanting stability as far as income is concerned. So on the one hand, we're hearing a lot about aspiration for things. And on the other hand, we're hearing that my goal is peace, joy, calm, and a good life. So it is a bit of an overwhelmed generation that we didn't hear that much overwhelming in the previous generations. And you know, Shankar's been tracking elections, I've been tracking people. So to that extent, I didn't hear that much of, I want also, and I'm overwhelmed also. So I think this is, in some ways, a little bit of an overwhelmed, a little bit of a lost generation in that kind of sense. But very aspiring, very concrete in their aspirations. And they're not saying, I want it here, I want it now, I want it this instant. They're saying that I will keep trying, and if this route doesn't work, I will take that other route. If the other route doesn't work, I'll take a third route. But, you know, dheere dheere hona chahiye.
And I'm going to come to Shankar in a sense. So now, Rama, if you were to contrast this with what they're actually experiencing. So let's say if you go back 10 years and we've had one government for the last 10 years, we've also had economic growth at a certain pace all through this period. There has been one section of the population which has obviously grown very wealthy. There's another section which has done better. And there may be a third section which, let's say, has in some ways got left behind. Now, if you were to now focus on the India 1 and the India 2, would you say that they are content with what they have? Or is their aspirational lead so strong that, you know, that could eventually, and whether you answer this or not, influence their voting choices?
Every time I look at Yashwant's data, it says, am I doing badly? Is the country, am I doing well or badly? Is the country doing well or badly? I mean, the number of people, even with your latest track that you put out, who turn around and say that I'm doing well and my country is doing well. Every time we look at data that says I have a lot of difficulty meeting my expenses, I have some difficulty meeting my expenses, we generally seem to believe that things will get better. But to more specifically answer your question, I think what they're saying is that there is a lot of agency and there's a lot of energy in terms of what they want to do. And they also recognize that there are lots of issues where the structure is not supporting them. Now we're seeing two, three kinds of people. There are some who fall by the wayside because when great agency hits bad structure, where do you end up? We also see the India 2, which is networked a little bit with India 1. So I would say everything is about half and half. So you'll also notice that those with chutzpah, those with connections, those with a network, those with some ability to get to where they want to get to are finding ways around it and doing it. Whether it is, you'll see it. I mean, you just ask Urban Company to send you a young somebody home and you will see that the ones that are coming in will tell you that I will also do this for you and I will also do that for you. And they're constantly trying to upsell and do that and so on. So there are some who will get around it and there are some, especially at the richer end, for whom structures are not an issue. I mean, they will make the world work, as they often tell you, for the way they want it to be. So it is all about, I think, the top half and the bottom half. So there is a certain group of young people who are, and the reason you're seeing a lot of, you know, pivot is now a fashionable word. I hate it because everyone's pivoting strategy all the time. But I think they tell you ki aise jayenge, ye nahi hoga to wo try karenge, wo nahi hoga to wo try karenge. Is this good news or bad news? To me, it is appalling news because you're creating, there's a whole group of people who don't have loyalty or ability to a profession or a particular way of making money. On the other hand, given the fluid environment, I think that is a pretty good life skill to have, that you would pivot here and pivot there, and you see that happening. You see that happening in signboards for businesses where you are 100% Thai, also make aloo ka paratha. I think you're seeing that. You're also seeing it in people. You're seeing them moving all the time. So I personally don't think the aspiration unfulfilled is going to blow up in everybody's faces, not just yet, is what I believe.
Shankar, so if you were to allow, let me put the question, I mean, it's the same question, but a little differently. Are the aspirations of voters today running ahead of what they are experiencing, whether at their in their jobs, in their quest for jobs, in their social structures, and in the pursuit of happiness, to borrow a term from somewhere else?
I think the question really we are looking at this is how much of inadequacy they are willing to tolerate. How much of failure they are willing to tolerate from the government, from the system that they have installed. And they have ownership of the system as long as they feel that that system is delivering to a certain extent. What you will see is that there is a definite divergence in the views. We are a two-speed or a three-speed economy, really speaking. So even within the rural area, whether you are landowning, not only dependent, tenant, farmer, whatever, all the aspects will play through. Whether you have somebody at home with a stable government job. So if you look at two interesting things that are happening in society, one is that every landowning community in India is in the queue for quota in government jobs and stuff. That reflects that they are not only feeling the loss of productivity income from the asset that they own, which is land, but they are also feeling the pinch of losing social and political standing in society. So if you are a landowning class in the rural area, you have a certain standing regardless of how well you have done in school or elsewhere. So there is that pinch that comes through, which is the threshold that you see across castes. The second thing that you see in urban area is that there is a sense, as Rama said, that is actually, I feel, a rising ability to blink at what they would not have tolerated earlier. So if they see somebody sort of working the system and getting ahead, the first question is not, is that right or wrong, but how do you do that? So the network effect then comes into play. And I think in that, there is a bit of immorality that you will see, because in a population of 1.4 billion people, I mean, just to give you a comparative, we are as many people as China, with one third the land mass and one sixth the per capita income, and probably one tenth of the systemic capacity that China has built over two decades of 9%+ growth. So that the economic power of an $18 trillion economy gives you the ability to set up capacity in that. India has just begun to do that. So there is a pride factor that we have, Vande Bharat, all the selfie moments that you see, you know, whether it is the Atal Setu or the Vande Bharat. I mean, you know, the Vande Bharat is a story in itself. I mean, you know, I don't know how fast it runs and whether there is a correlation between the fare and the speed and the timing of all that, but we leave that for another discussion. It triggers a sense of pride for people that metro aa gaya hamare yahan se, road ban gaya. It doesn't matter to them, they are all paying tolls on roads that were built. And I mean, you know, the Bombay Pune Expressway is effectively almost 30 years old and you're still paying tolls. There are those questions that don't pop up, but people like to feel the pride of it. So one of the things that has happened over the last 5 or 6 years is the sense that the youngsters have that India has sort of arrived at some junction, and that junction is where they are going to board the train or the flight, and they want all the bells and whistles that come with that junction. Whether you need to travel to X, Y, Z, or you want to set up a business. And there is a sense of confidence in that area. At the same time, there is another set of people who feel left out. And that, whether that visits the electoral outcomes or visits the social questions, it certainly is visiting the balance sheets of certain companies. That's, there's no doubt about it. It is also visiting the GDP data as you look at consumption. But whether it has a political impact depends on, if I don't install this app, which app do I install? Come back to that question, whether there is a relative merit or a competitive position by the other side of the story.
Okay, and I think, Shankar, you made a good point on, and a useful point on, the importance of infrastructure building and its overall visual effect, for lack of any other term, on the population as a whole. So, you know, let me come to the other point, and this is the sort of maybe the most open-ended one, right? What's the idea of India as we go into the 2024 elections? And some of it may have come through from the survey, but because Yashwan does say that there is a sense of optimism which is running through. But what is the idea of India at this point of time? And maybe the question is a little more towards the younger voters or first-time voters. I think it's as a general concept as well, maybe with an economic lens, it would be good to hear your views. And Shankar, let me go with you.
Younger voter looks at this idea of India in terms of pure per capita income basis, with a social connect, with a cultural connect. So let's say that is similar to the evolution of the nuclear family. So the person thinks of himself or herself in a nuclear fashion. He or she looks at a target of per capita, her income, her ownership, her experiences, and builds a narrative around it. And that narrative is important to that person. That narrative is what binds that person to the society, to the general larger political band. Now, the moment that narrative is disturbed, in any fashion, in any extreme position, there will be a reaction and there will be a pushback against that. And so that pops up in different places, whether it is an excess of populism, whether it is an excess of religious extremism, whether you are told what to eat, when to eat, not to eat, all of those things are in the personal beliefs and personal freedoms domain that they sort of value a lot. Sitting right on top of all of that is the number of decimals in the number that they aspire to.
Okay. Ramat, you've talked about, I mean, we're obviously trying to look at the idea of India as seen through the eyes of maybe younger people right now. So when you say maybe less emotional, inconsistent, more rational, so these are some of the terms that you've used. How does the idea of India flow from this?
Yeah, actually some of the terms I think Shankar used, but I'm happy to take them on. So it is actually parochial, narrow, local, me and my immediate environment. I think what we have seen over the years, every time you do youth studies and people used to say, why is India's youth not rebellious? I think within the sandbox of what you are supposed to do or not supposed, within the sandbox of affiliation, they're willing to do their individualism. So even now, it is not, it's not ideologism. We're building this great country. We're doing these great things. Desh aage badh raha hai. We're not hearing that. What we're really hearing is that, yes, I'm Indian. I can go anywhere I want and I can come back. I'm Indian because that's the way it is. Yes, there are things that are not right with this place, but, you know, dheere dheere ho jayega. As compared to it's my job, ideologically, this is a big country. This is the country I wanted to be. So I think that's a point, that one point I was making, that it's more a social and cultural view of the country. They say, yes, my parents are supportive of me, but they're not able to give me the community and the peers that I need. Ideally, I want the anonymity of the metro town and the liberalism in the sense nobody gossips and tells my mother what I've been up to, but I also want the rootedness of a small town. So as you can see, every one of these, if you add it to the fact that they don't seem to even know at the moment what their politics actually is, they're eminently magnetizable, right? Because this is really someone saying that I'm crying out for the rootedness. So it's all seen through the social lens of me and what can he do for me and what's going to happen to me, and I need progress in my life.
So we tend to look at all these issues, whether the person or the party or the institution or the country is in mission mode. I think the young voter is not exactly in mission mode. He doesn't see it as a kind of doesn't harbor a messiah complex. I think the person, younger voter, looks at it as something that has got to be done. So more consumption, more experience mode, more aspiration mode, and less mission mode.
Okay. Rama, so, you know, you've talked about the generation being hyper-aware, and you've also talked about overstimulation and talked about, let's say, low shelf life for issues. Is all of that affecting the way people look at their identity in the context of the country?
We've seen that they are completely overwhelmed and anxious, and whatever they're seeing on social media, there is a lot of it, and they talk about it all the time. As I said earlier, I don't think it's about the country the way we think about the country, or certainly the way my generation 100 years ago thought about the country, but it is about what is happening for me. And even social issues are issues, so they're magnetized by social media. So social media is magnetizing you and telling you what it is you're thinking, what your political thoughts ought to be, I suppose, closer to the elections. I love the app analogy, but what app do I install is also part of coming closer to it, just the hyper-awareness of who's installing what app, isne ye install kiya. The other thing is that because they want the best of both worlds, like stability of a government job, but freedom to aspire and try everything. I want the safety of the family, but I want the excitement of peer. I'm overwhelmed and anxious, and I want someone to make sense of it for me. So that's the mahol. So I think closer to the time, which app to install will also be a function of who gets the, I hate to sound like a callous marketeer, but it's who gets the marketing engineering right. It's not about marketing strategy at all. And we know that's likely to be.
That's a very important point there. And perhaps also speaks to maybe how, let's say, the current government has managed its messaging in the last few years. So let me come to the last point. I know we've not touched upon social media independently, but I can see how it's, you know, playing into a lot of things that we've already talked about and its role in influencing either current voters or older voters. So the last question is really, how is the political system plugging into this, all of that we've talked about? Are they able to exploit it and use some of these things, whether it's the infrastructure, the ability to use those aspirations, the ability to meet those information needs, and then, you know, present something which makes it a good electable proposition? And equally, what are they not getting right? I think that's the other question that I think one should address. Shankar, what are politicians getting right? How are they using all these changes, these insights that we've talked about? And where are they not perhaps seeing what is going on? Or are they seeing and then maybe not able to do anything about it?
I think there's a lot of retrofitting. So they're doing what they're doing and they're presenting it as solutions on questions that are being raised by in the minds of the voters or the youngsters. So one of the things that they have caught on to, I mean, most of the parties have caught on to, is that in the age of technology, there is a certain instantness that is expected on issues and solutions. And so still, the number of governments which are now delivering rations at home, like Zomato or Google, whichever service Google Eats or whatever, and presenting that as kind of coming, bringing the government to the doorstep of the person, that's a kind of thing. The use of NPCI and UPI, regardless of where it was born, who worked on it or whatever. Those are things that are being represented, presented as solutions. And so the youngsters are invested in that idea. What the politicians should not mistake is that this generation, it's not anybody's fault. They're not going to be taken in. They might nod at something, but they know inside. They test out things that are being told, and they have as much cynicism in their blood as the previous generations. So there is a skepticism and cynicism which they approach any government claim or boast. And if it tests out right, they are willing to sort of back that claim, invest in that idea. I think that the point where the politicians don't get it is the long-term view that they see. Where will we be? What will be the kind of life? How will we solve, for instance, the water problem? How will we solve the air pollution problem? These are real issues in the minds of the people. And any sense, any tactical duplicity that is practiced by the politician is instantly exposed, and then, you know, all the memes that you say or see on social media are largely the result of that. And there are several jokes, dark humor sort of is one way to get through this.
Right. Okay. Last word, Rama. So as we look ahead, you know, we've covered, let's say, a fairly broad spectrum of issues in the context of what people desire, further in the context of what they're already experiencing and their aspirations. So as you look ahead, I mean, let me not put the politicians' questions to you. What will really determine the sense of, let's say, achievement or happiness? And will politics play any role in it? Or to what extent will it play a role in it in coming years?
That's a tougher question than saying who will they vote for. But I think there is one thing that, while I agree with cynicism, I think this is also overwhelmed and anxious for many reasons, this particular generation that we have here, the young people. So I think the overwhelmed and anxious, who can tap into that? And we're not taking names here, but I think whoever can tap into the overwhelmed and the anxious is definitely going to be. So it's overwhelmed and anxious in one direction. So who is seen to be the best beacon for that generation to follow? And the second is, what's in it for me? And I think the what's in it for me, I agree with Shankar that people aren't saying enough of what's in it for me. But I think it is, if someone can customize, if you can do mass customization of politics in terms of what's in it for me, I think that's really where the future is. I think they're just saying, I want to live a better life. I know I can live a better life. I'm willing to do what it takes to live a better life. And I think they've done their bit in terms of agency. And I think that whoever can provide them the best structure for their lives to get better is really, I think, where politics plays a role. But it's about social, cultural, parochial me. It's not about, I would, if somebody had a slogan that said, Desh aage bad raha hai, Desh jai jawan jai kisan, I would be very worried about whether they're tapping into any pulse or not.
One word that I want to sort of leave us all to think about. This is a generation that is very entitled. And they want that entitled sense of entitlement, the sense of aspiration and entitlement as sort of morphing. And they want that addressed. And anybody who gets that will get their vote.
Right, right. And good note to end on. Rama, Shankar and Yashwant, thank you so much for joining me and sharing your thoughts, and look forward to seeing you all again.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Bhavan.
That was The Core Report with me, Govindraj Ethiraj. Do stay connected with more of our coverage at The Core. You can check out our website or sign up to our newsletter for our exclusive stories, one in-depth feature a day on www.thecore.in. Do also track us on LinkedIn, where we usually post synopses or extracts of our top stories and interviews. We would love your feedback on how we can make business more interesting and relevant, including, of course, India's vibrant manufacturing sector. So write to us at feedback@thecore.in. And thank you once again for listening.